Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we're going to talk about the various efforts to hold people accountable for the January 6th insurgency of dunces with Brandy Buckman from Daily Coast. Then we're going to be joined by Michael Grunewald, co-host of the Climavores podcast, to talk about a piece he had in the New York Times last week about how our food production is destroying the climate and what's being done to wean us off of some of the more destructive kinds of production, namely raising livestock for meat and dairy. By the way, we recorded that interview yesterday, and after we did, I went to the supermarket and picked up some Impossible Chicken Nuggets, plant-based nuggets. And while I am not a big fan of chicken nuggets, I found them to be almost exactly the same as those made with real chicken. So there you go. Anyway, before we get to that, there is a really crazy story developing in Washington, D.C., in New York, in Washington, D.C. You may have heard of this Republican, you probably did, who just recently flipped a formerly blue state, a blue seat in New York, red. The guy's name is George Santos, and he helped Republicans take the House with a slim margin in the midterms. So again, I imagine you saw the story earlier this week about how Santos' biography was all phony. He claimed he'd attended NYU. NYU had no records of that. He said he'd graduated from Baruch College. I don't know how to pronounce that. Baruch College. No record of that. He said that he'd worked at Goldman Sachs and Citibank. No, again, the unit he claimed to have worked at when he was at Citibank had actually been shut down years earlier. Didn't even exist. Even the animal rescue charity that he claimed to have run appears to have been bogus. There was no nonprofit registered to him. Reporters did find that he had held one fundraiser for an animal shelter, but then he kept the money and ghosted the shelter. So various media outlets have kept reporting on this guy throughout the week. And it just keeps getting weirder and weirder. So Santos has claimed that he is half Jewish. That appears to have been a lie. He claimed that he had Ukrainian roots. No evidence of that. He claimed that his grandparents had survived the Holocaust, but they were in Brazil at the time. Santos ran as a half Jewish and openly gay Republican. That was kind of central to his biography on the campaign trail. And he was touted as, like, you know, this very different kind of Republican for these reasons. But the Daily Beast unearthed a divorce from a woman in his past. Now, of course, a gay person can be in an opposite sex marriage and then get a divorce. But I think given that this dude has lied about literally every aspect of his biography, the more likely scenario is that he also lied about his sexual orientation. Okay, so a bizarre story. And quite frankly, I do not even understand how you can become one of just 535 members of the United States Congress without getting any kind of vetting from the media or your political opponents. I don't understand how that happens. But setting that aside, this story gets even weirder if you can believe that. So this Santos guy, and by the way, he went by the name DeVolder until shortly before running for Congress. So I think Santos is one of his parents' names, but his other parent is named DeVolder, and he went by DeVolder and then changed it to Santos. So this Santos guy is obviously a hustler. He allegedly ran some kind of Ponzi scheme for a while. But he also has a history of having apparent money problems. He'd been evicted from multiple apartments for failing to pay rent. And then suddenly he was flush with cash. And there was no verifiable source of his newfound riches. He claimed to have made a bunch of money in real estate, but that appears to have been a lie as well. So when I saw that, I was like, wait a second, this is all very fishy. I said, I would not be surprised if there was like some foreign intelligence service involved in this. And then the Daily Beast reported that a Russian oligarch had funneled $56,000 into Santos' campaign. And then Santos started spouting pro-Russian propaganda and calling Ukraine a corrupt fascist state and all of that. Again, after claiming previously that he had that his family had originated in Ukraine. Now, I have no idea what's going on here. There are obviously plenty of wingnuts pushing Russian propaganda for free, but I will say that it seems entirely possible that the 56K is just the tip of the iceberg, and maybe the Russians bought themselves a phony, a real representative, but a phony guy, bought a phony guy representing them a congressional seat. I don't know. Now, if we had two serious political parties, this guy would never be seated, but I think you can expect Republicans to welcome him into the fold. And we'll see where all of this goes. There's going to be a probe. I think the feds are looking into this. You know, maybe some criminal action down the road. Obviously, the ethics process in Congress is toothless, fangless. So, anyway, with that, let's take a quick break. We'll come back in 1 minute. We'll take a quick break and come back. Stay tuned. All the lights are coming on. Welcome back. Let's talk about an issue that I find to be a general conundrum, and that is meat and dairy. I'm a guy who owns three different smokers and grills. I love meat, and I am obviously concerned about the climate, and I am cognizant of the fact that eating meat as our climate crisis accelerates is deeply problematic and downright unethical. But my efforts in the past to reduce or eliminate animal products from my diet have not been sustainable. I just always come back to it. So let's talk about that a little bit. I'm joined now by Michael Grunewald. Mike is a veteran journalist. He mostly covers the broad climate beat. He's a host of the Climavores podcast and the author of several books, and he's currently working on a new book on this very subject. And Mike had an excellent piece in the New York Times last week. It was titled, "No One Wants to Say Put Down That Burger, But We Really Should." You can find that piece on the New York Times website, and I suggest that you do. Michael Grunewald, welcome back to We've Got Issues.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Joshua.
Thanks for taking the time. In a gut punch of a lead, you write, and I quote, "Earth is in the midst of the worst mass extinction since an asteroid wiped out the dinosaurs 66 million years ago, and this time the asteroid is us." And a lot of asteroid-like behavior comes down to our voracious appetites for agricultural land, grow meat and dairy, and also fuel. Let's begin by getting a sense of the kind of scale of this problem. If we were to lean more heavily on a plant-based diet, we'd still need plenty of agricultural land, right? So why is meat eating a threat to an estimated 25% of all of the species on planet Earth?
Well, the short answer is that the Earth is kind of becoming an animal farm. It's, you know, half of the Earth is now agriculture, and the other half is basically nature. You know, urban, you know, all our highways and dryways and you know, just our cities and towns, that's just like 1.5% of the earth. It's really agriculture and nature, and agriculture is winning. And really at this point, about 3/4 of that agricultural land is either directly for grazing livestock or it's for growing crops that we feed to livestock. And so it's really pretty simple. If we, you know, if we eat fewer animals, we will need less land and we will have more Amazon. It's kind of not pretty. And I should say that beef and to a slightly lesser extent, lamb are way worse than chicken and pork. So like you, I have really struggled with, you know, I'm doing the Climavores podcast and I still eat meat, but I have cut out beef because beef is like 10 times worse than chicken and pork.
I think that's actually a really important thing because I can eat a lot more pork and a lot less beef. I love pork. It's a great, great food. I'm reading a book about an archaeological text about ancient Greece, and they used to consume, it's estimated, obviously they're working off of archaeological evidence. They believe that ancient Greeks consumed 80% of their calories from grains and olive oil. And then about 10 to 15% were from nuts, seeds, and fruits and vegetables. And they used to consume about 5 to 10% of their calories from meat. And that was often associated with festivals. They'd basically do sacrifice to the gods. And then everybody would get a piece of ox or whatever was sacrificed. And just a very different culture and a different way to consume, you know, to keep yourself alive. You kind of hook this piece to the COP15 conference on biodiversity, which just concluded in Montreal this Monday. I don't think it's a stretch to say that you were unimpressed with the commitments that were made during this conference or even hopeful that they will fulfill those commitments. You write, and I quote, "Unfortunately, telling people what to eat and farmers how to farm are politically unpalatable tasks, which helps explain why yak fests like COP15 tend to obscure the problem with the word salad." I wonder if you could unpack that for us a little bit. Why is there a tendency to obscure the central problem? And what is that word salad? What are they looking at? And what are they saying the problem is?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's funny that you mentioned how the ancient Greeks, and I liked what you were getting at, this idea that, you know, maybe at some point, meat and particularly beef has to become this kind of luxury, you know, occasional item.
Yeah.
But we also get very few of our calories from meat, despite the fact that we eat an awful lot of it. It's 80% of our ag land, but it's still less than 20% of our calories. And in the United States, it's even more extreme.
Does that include dairy?
My statistics. No, that's just meat.
Okay.
But yeah, so again, we do like dairy too. But again, I think this is the sort of, when you ask what COP15 is dancing around, they're dancing around this, the fact that we need to eat less meat, eat less beef, find better replacements. Some of that is going to require biotechnology, some of these, you know, alternative proteins, and also alternative farming techniques. And as there actually was one of the 24 action items in Montreal was about biotechnology, but it wasn't like we need to invest in biotechnology across the world. It was we need to manage the risks of biotechnology. So again, sort of tech is kind of seen as a, you know, a potential pitfall rather than a potential solution. So I think there's just, look, I mean, agricultural industries in just about every country have a lot of political power, and nobody wants to come out and say, you need to shrink your footprint. We need more nature and fewer farms. And it's okay not to say that, but then we're going to keep having this biodiversity problem. I think to their credit, they did come out with these at least goals of protecting a lot of land, but ultimately the problem is agricultural demand. We we are eating a lot of meat, which in our current system means we need a lot of land. And as long as we keep eating all that meat, we're going to keep using the land, no matter, you know, where we put a, you know, we can put a fence around one particular area and say that's protected land. But either then we'll take down forests somewhere else, or we'll ultimately take down that fence if we need that land for food.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to talk about some potential solutions, but before we do that, there are a couple of closely related problems that listeners should understand. First, we grow food and then just throw it away. We waste it. I was shocked and also kind of guilty to read in your piece that we just throw away a third of the food we produce, even as we're decimating wild habitats to turn them into farmland. Then you talk about our increasing reliance on biofuels. And this is all against a backdrop of both human population growth and also people consuming more meat as they are, as they emerge from poverty, as they're, you know, we lift parts of the global population come out of poverty, they tend to eat more meat. The focus of your Times piece is land, but meat farming comes with other environmental consequences. Can you talk about those other problems just briefly?
Sure. I mean, especially with ruminants like, you know, like cows, you know, they everybody talks about their farts, but it's mostly burps. They burp an extraordinary amount of methane, which is a really potent greenhouse gas, even worse than carbon, although it doesn't stick around quite as long. Also, their manure creates methane as well as nitrous oxide, which is an even more potent greenhouse gas. But really, the big one is the is that they're eating the earth, right? The and look, I think what you said is true about you know, in the developing world, as people, one thing we know about lifestyle change is that the first thing people do when they get less poor is they eat more meat. And that's kind of great, because as you know with your smokers, right, like meat is delicious.
Yeah.
And it is in some, and it has a lot of nutrition. In the rich world, we eat way too much of it. Like nutrition, you know, we're not, you know,
we're fat.
Yeah. Over nutrified.
Yeah.
You know, but in a lot of the world, it's great that they eat meat and, you know, trying to get more meat. And remember, I mean, our ancestors started eating meat 2.5 million years ago. And in some ways, it's part of what made us human, right? When we started eating more meat,
it allowed us to have those big brains, right?
Exactly. We needed the big brains to kind of, you know, to try to outsmart our prey and smaller stomachs, right? Because we weren't just, you know, eating, you know,
grazing the grass
all day long, like cows do. And they have those super awesome stomachs. But so, yeah, I guess what I'm saying is, like, this is very deeply ingrained in us. You know, there's something about when you bite into meat, that kind of, you know, the aroma, that something in, you know, that mouthfeel, that chew, that meaty taste, that just, you know, something goes off in our brains. So that even though a lot of us are upset about the way chickens are treated, and certainly about the impact on climate change and what's happening to the Amazon and what's happening to the macaws and the jaguars and biodiversity, we still can't quit.
Yeah. There was a viral story a few months back. Cracker Barrel, the kind of hick-friendly chain of stores and restaurants, added a plant-based sausage to its menu. Yeah. And this created like a firestorm among right wingers. They absolutely melted down. They accused the chain of going woke. And I just want to stress that Cracker Barrel was not considering phasing out its pork sausage or whatever. I think they offer sausages made out of a number of different animals. Like you can get a beef sausage, you can get it, right? It was just the addition of this other choice that infuriated all these morons. So you have people like that on the one hand, and then you have people like you and me, guilty people who just can't seem to break the habit and, you know, wish that we could. It seems kind of clear that you can't just mandate your way out of this problem, or even like tax your way out of it. So that, yeah, I think
it's a real problem. You know, we did an episode about that Cracker Barrel thing on Climavores, and one thing you realize is, like, you know, assuming the developing world is going to eat more meat, that basically the rich world, we have to cut, particularly our beef consumption, we have to cut in half. And if these, you know,
lunatics, you can say lunatics.
They're like, oh, I eat twice as much meat. Well, then, we're kind of screwed, right?
It's the rolling coal of cuisine.
Exactly. Yeah. They're going to own the libs by eating
an entire beef, yeah. An entire side of beef.
Exactly. By turning your arteries into stone. That'll learn that.
I mean, if you look at, that was an extreme effort, but everything we're talking about, it is extremely difficult to deal with this without having different choices. And I think this brings efforts to innovate our way out of this problem kind of to the forefront. For your book, I presume, you recently took a tour of companies that are creating like meat and dairy products without raising animals. Where are we with that effort? Can you tell us a little bit about your experiences with this burgeoning industry of manufactured meats?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think you laid it out really well in that changing hearts and minds is really hard, and it's more likely that we're going to change food. I always tell the story that in the late 19th century, the animal welfare movement actually got its start, the ASPCA got its start because carriage horses were being treated horribly. And the ASPCA was founded to basically clamor for watering stations for these horses, shorter working hours for the horses. They even wanted the Sabbath off for the horses. But of course, the ASPCA didn't save the horses. Henry Ford did, right? He came up with a sort of better form of transportation that people liked better. And I think that's, for the main part, that's what's going to have to happen with food. We're going to have to come up with, forms of consumption that if they don't taste better, they at least taste as good or indistinguishable, and they're as inexpensive as meat. It's happening, right? There's been a lot of, like, Beyond Meat went public in 2019, and it was like the biggest IPO of the teens. It was absurdly overhyped, and the stock went from 20 up to 250, and now of course it's crashed down to 15. And it's being absurdly underhyped, and everybody's saying, "See, this was a joke all along." But I think just as Pets.com did not reflect, the long term prospects of the internet, I think there's really exciting things happening in alternative proteins, both with the plant based side, where yes, Beyond is struggling, but Impossible is still doing well. Their nuggets are great. You can get their breakfast sausage in Starbucks, which I think is, really good. The Impossible Whopper, again, you're just making a Whopper, which is not a, it's, do you even call that meat? But it tastes like a Whopper.
It tastes as bad as a regular Whopper.
Exactly. And you're starting, the plant-based is very exciting. You're starting to see some really interesting work with fermentation, which is sort of like brewing beer or the way we make insulin today. There are companies like Perfect Day, which has raised $750 million to basically make whey protein in a giant fermentation tank, where they genetically modify these yeast to basically express the actual animal protein. And you're going to start, I tried their cream cheese, and it is cream cheese. It's really good. You're going to start seeing them. They're doing ice cream. That I think is very promising. And you're even starting to see some of these cell-based meats or cultivated meats, where they're growing the actual meat from animal cells. Just Foods is now, they've got approval to sell it in Singapore. And so they're doing, an occasional dinner here or there. I got to try their chicken, and it tastes like chicken because it is chicken. They're growing it from actual cells. It's still way too expensive to be competitive. But considering that in 2013, when they made the first cell-based burger and it cost $1 million a pound, they're probably now down to in the hundreds of dollars per pound, which is, you know, a little more than $5 a pound you can get at the grocery store. But yeah, it's really impressive. So yeah, I had cell-based chicken. I had cell-based sushi. This stuff is coming. The question is just how fast it's coming and how much meat it can displace.
I don't want to give the impression that we can all sit back and just wait for, you know, technological wonders to take over. I think that cultural shifts are also part of the solution, are necessary part of the solution. But this is a really important piece of the picture. And I would encourage people to, you know, maybe think about the smaller changes that you can make without asking you to just, you know, become a vegan or whatever. Maybe switch and eat a little bit less beef, maybe eat a little bit more pork, and maybe try some of these new products that are coming out. The Beyond Burger is, or is it the Impossible? Which one did I get? The Impossible Burger is really good.
Like that's the Impossible, I think, is way better. And
it's really good. I'm
mentioning that since the 70s, probably aside from the recent rise of solar power, probably the best thing that has happened to the climate over the last half century has been the shift in the rich world from beef to chicken. Which has been a disaster for chickens, right? We should say they're, you know, we now kill like 70 billion chickens a year and they're treated horribly and it's just disgusting what we do to them. But that has reduced our emissions from meat by like a third. So eating less beef is really important. And I will say that on a lot of these alternatives, particularly the kind of homogenous type of, chicken nuggets, I mean, the head of one of the chicken nugget companies told me, she's like, nuggets are just a vehicle for sauce.
And, right, for breading and sauce.
Meat nuggets, like there's all kind of disgusting stuff in there.
Yeah.
It's really no sacrifice to switch to even like some of the old school veggie burger companies, like Gardein makes really good chicken nuggets. So things like that, the little burger patties, the sausages, it's not such a sacrifice to switch. Right now there's no equivalent of a steak. There just isn't. And there probably isn't going to be for a while. I think, less is better, but I'm not going to get on my high horse because I know it's really hard.
Yeah.
Because meat is really awesome.
Yeah, it is. Mike, I believe we are out of time, but before I let you go, I just want to ask you, when can we expect the book to come out?
Probably like a year away, but you can hear the Climavores podcast. And I'm writing columns for Canary Media about this stuff. My column's called Eating the Earth. And as you saw, I have been writing for the Times, for the Atlantic. And so I'm trying to freelance about food and climate.
Mike, when the book comes out, we're going to have you back on the show to talk about it. Folks, check out the Climavores podcast wherever you get your podcast, and also go read Mike's piece in the New York Times. Michael Grunewald, I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
It's always a pleasure, Joshua. Oh, Santa, I've been killing just for fun. Well, the party's over, kid, because I got a bullet in my gun. A bullet in your what? Around.
Welcome back. I'm happy to be joined now by Brandi Buckman. Brandi is a senior staff writer at Daily Coast, and she's been diligently covering the January 6th investigations in Congress and the January 6th prosecutions in the courts. Brandi, welcome back to We've Got Issues.
Thanks so much for having me, Josh. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for taking the time. I have 2 hours worth of stuff to cover with you in around 15 minutes. So let's just jump right in. Sure. The January 6th Select Committee wrapped up its public hearings this week with a flourish, referring Donald Trump, of course, for prosecution on 4 charges. They are obstruction of an official proceeding, conspiracy to defraud the United States. This was a charge that the legal scholar Randall Eliason talked about on this show way back in like early 2021. Conspiracy to make a false statement. And this is the one that I love. Conspiracy to defraud the U.S. by assisting, aiding, or comforting those involved in an insurrection, which is an offense that has not been charged in this country since the Civil War era. Of course, we haven't had an insurrection since then. So, of course,
right.
Politico ran a story headlined, and here I quote, DOJ cares about the evidence, not the criminal referrals. And then the New York Times ran another piece headlined, why the January 6th committee referrals to Trump for Trump and others matter. Mm-hmm. So you have these two like dueling narratives. Sure. We know these referrals aren't binding on the DOJ, but do they matter?
Yeah, I think that they do matter in some ways. I think that they're important because this is a pretty big event that we have here. The magnitude of the charges that are involved, the magnitude of the allegations, the evidence that was amassed over 18 months of investigating. I mean, this is it. You can't go through all of this and then come to the end of it and walk away and say, well, we don't refer him to the Criminal Justice Department. Because even if it's a symbol, it's a crucial symbol to send. And it's basically just the committee saying for once and all at the end of this whole process, hey, we have found evidence that we believe is indicative of a crime, and we would like you to investigate this. Now, the ways that it's not important, the Justice Department is already investigating Donald Trump and the role that he may have played in the insurrection, and as well as many other issues. Yeah. So really, this is just kind of like a marrying of all of this information that has been amassed for some time now.
Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland, a member of the committee, said that the Department of Justice could charge Trump with additional offenses, and they considered referring Trump for other charges, but these were the ones that they deemed to be kind of like slam dunks. My wording, not his, right?
Yeah.
Punchbowl News reported that the committee and its staff are now extensively cooperating, that's a quote, with the DOJ and with special counsel Jack Smith's investigation. What is the significance of that?
So, you know, this was something that the chairman of the committee, Benny Thompson, had said pretty much this whole summer. As soon as we're done with our investigation, we're going to cooperate with the Justice Department, meaning that we're going to give them all of these deposition transcripts that we've taken, any of the records that we've amassed that perhaps they don't have. And we're going to share it with them because we know that they're also conducting their own investigations. It was very important to keep the separation of powers between Congress and between the Justice Department, especially on a subject like this. So they were pretty cagey about it all summer. And now that this is sort of started to wind down, as was promised by Thompson, once we were done with the investigation, we would hand it over to you guys. And so this is important because there is a lot of detail in some of these transcripts. And I've just spent the last, you know, 48 hours or 24 hours starting to read over some of them. And, you know, there's just so much here. And there's a lot of nuance that I think, as a person who's not a federal prosecutor, and not necessarily aware of all of the details involved with existing indictments or upcoming trials, things of this nature, you know, there could be stuff in these transcripts that will help them sort of fill in the blanks.
Right. I should just note for listeners who haven't been paying that much attention that the committee also referred Mark Meadows, the former chief of staff, Rudy Giuliani, the former clown and lawyer, I guess. Although I think he's in the process of being disbarred, possibly. Another lawyer, John Eastman, who is the mastermind of the whole fake electors scheme. And he was also plotting to fire the AG and replace him with a guy named Jeff Clark, who is this environmental attorney in DOJ and a wingnut who believed all these conspiracy theories. Eastman was also going to negotiate a deal with Clarence Thomas. It's crazy that we have a Supreme Court justice involved in all of this. They referred Jeff Clark himself for prosecution, and Kenneth Chesbro, who is, he's not really a well-known person, huh?
Yeah.
Who is Kenneth Chesbro?
So Kenneth is basically a Trump lawyer who was integral in the fake elector scheme. You know, he was sort of working behind the scenes, advancing these pro-Trump elector slates, coordinating with Giuliani, according to a lot of the evidence and testimony and records that we've seen already, and just sort of setting up these back channels to get those slates going.
He was giving detailed directions to those phony electors about exactly how to package the thing and where to send their phony certificates.
Right.
So he's got some dirty hands. There's another story here, and it's wild how corrupt all the lawyers are. There's another story here, which the committee hinted at without naming names. You wrote about it at Daily Kos. It's Trump's former White House ethics lawyer, Stephen Passantino, who later represented Cassidy Hutchinson. And listeners may remember her. She was the Mark Meadows aide who gave very dramatic testimony during the hearings. Passantino now appears to be in some hot water. By the way, I find it hilarious that Trump had an ethics lawyer at all. Like, I wonder what that guy did all day. Anyway, what do we know about that story?
Well, you know, the Cassidy Hutchinson transcripts, at least two of the transcripts of hers came out today as well. And we got to see a little bit more in these transcripts about what Passantino was advising her according to her testimony. And, you know, some of this stuff was it was pretty shocking. Now, she said to the committee that Passantino never instructed her to lie directly. And she was very clear about that. But it seems to be, according to her anyway, that he did instruct her to mislead the committee. And one of the things that he had sort of remarked to her was, you know, look, Cassidy, they don't know what you don't know. They don't know what you do know. So you can just say, I don't recall. And so there's definitely some funkiness that's going on with that. And, you know, this was a Trump lawyer who was having his attorney's fees paid by the Save America PAC, which is Trump's political action committee. And she felt really trapped, according to her testimony, because she couldn't afford some of these high dollar lawyers outside of the ones that the Trump world was willing to provide to her. She eventually, you know, broke bonds with him because she just felt incredibly pressured. She felt very uncomfortable. She didn't feel like he had her best interests in heart. And so this gentleman, I did try to reach out to his office the other day, and I was not able to get in touch with anyone, but I did notice that his biography had been yanked from his law firm's webpage. The law firm has kind of taken a step back from him in terms of just saying, you know, he didn't do anything appropriate. We're not really commenting on this. And he himself has sort of just flatly denied that he ever instructed her to mislead investigators. So I wouldn't be surprised if we don't hear a little bit more from him in the months ahead here.
Yeah. He has taken a leave of absence from his firm, according to reports. I would just note that this is exactly what Nixon instructed people to do, just saying they could not remember.
Right.
He said, you know, you don't have to lie. You just say that you don't recall. Right. This is the second criminal referral for Mark Meadows. He and Dan Scavino both blew off the committee's subpoenas. Now, the Department of Justice declined to charge either man for doing that. But they did charge Steve Bannon for the exact same thing. He was found guilty and is awaiting sentencing. Right. What should we make of these disparate outcomes for Bannon on the one hand and Meadows and Scavino on the other?
Well, you have to think about the difference in what really happened with these folks. So Bannon flat out refused to cooperate with the committee, missed deadlines, didn't produce any documents whatsoever. Mark Meadows, Dan Scavino, they did provide documents. They did meet with the committee. Now, they abruptly ended their cooperation. But I mean, Mark Meadows turned over something like, I want to say it was 2,900 texts. I know it was over 2,000 texts. It was a huge number of them. And a lot of these details that we've sort of seen splashed across cable news and we've seen online and in newspapers about Mark Meadows, a lot of this came from the communications that he shared. So, I mean, I don't know exactly what was in the minds of the Justice Department when they decided this, but all things being fair, both of those individuals did a lot more than what Steve Bannon did. And I think that that might have saved them from that contempt charge. Now, whether or not they will be, especially Meadows, you know, he will be able to save himself or escape from any kind of other criminal referral, especially involving obstruction or conspiracy, you know, that remains to be seen. And that might be a separate issue. I have a feeling that Mark Meadows might have just, you know, cut his nose to spite his face here.
Yeah. So you're not buying the speculation that maybe they're cooperating?
I don't know. You know, I'm not big on speculating on that end in particular, but yeah, who knows? With these folks, anything is possible.
Yeah, that is true. Brandy, I want to shift gears. By the way, folks, we're recording this on Thursday. The entire report is coming out today, and it's going to take a while to process. We're going to have more on this story in the coming weeks, believe me. So I want to shift gears a little bit briefly to talk a little bit about what's going on in terms of prosecuting people a little lower down on the food chain. You covered the Oath Keepers trial, or I should say the first Oath Keepers trial, because there are more coming. That ended with convictions of all of the accused on serious felonies, although not on all charges, but all of them ended up with serious felonies. And jury selection was underway this week in a similar case against members of another extremist group, the Proud Boys. Brandy, can you give us a little preview of the government's case against these goons?
Yeah, sure. So the Proud Boys seditious conspiracy case will start in earnest on January 3rd of next year. That's when we get the opening statements to begin. Now, right now, they're at the courthouse and they're doing jury selection. And they've apparently been having a little bit of back and forth here, as is to be expected with these folks. You know, they are of the opinion, the Proud Boys are of the opinion that you can't get a fair jury in D.C. Well, the Oath Keepers certainly got a fair jury in D.C. They had a mixed bag of their verdicts. Some of them were acquitted on some of the obstruction charges. Yes. So that sort of tells us that our juries here in Washington are able to think for themselves and they understand the rules of the road. Now, they have gotten rid of folks already. I've not been at jury selection because I've been focused on the committees, but I've been reading that they got rid of jurors who had ties to the White House or who had federal jobs. There was one lady who said that she felt the Proud Boys were suffering from a delusional superhero complex, and the judge dismissed her. So, you know, if the Proud Boys jury selection is anything at all like jury selection was for the first Oath Keepers case back in October, which I did sit in on, it is extensive. You know, they're going through quite a process to weed out folks who are not appropriate to sit for the jury. But this next one, I'm actually really looking forward to this particular trial. I think it's going to be really, really interesting. And I think that there's just so much about the Proud Boys that we just don't even realize how extensive this alleged conspiracy is, you know?
Yeah. I should say that this has been a consistent theme in all sorts of January 6th trials, with defendants asking for changes of venue and judges shooting them down and saying, look, this is not a local news story. Every jurisdiction in the country has had media coverage of these events. And, you know, you can't just say, oh, well, D.C. is full of liberals, so we're not going to have a trial here. That doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
Are the charges against these guys similar to the ones in the Oath Keepers case?
Yeah, they are similar to the ones in the Oath Keepers case. You know, we have a lot of overlap here. And the sedition charge is the one that really interests me. You know, it's a tough hurdle to climb to begin with. And I think that one of the issues with the Oath Keepers case with Stuart Rhodes, and one of the criticisms that I was hearing as we were going along was, you know, the prosecution is never going to be able to get this sedition conspiracy, seditious this conspiracy charge over the line because it needs to be more specific. And these guys just didn't have an explicit, concrete plan. Let's attack the Capitol and stop the certification. But as was explained to the jury, and as a new jury will soon learn, and as Mr. Tario will soon become himself more acquainted with this, you don't have to have an explicit agreement to be convicted or charged with seditious conspiracy. All you have to have is basically an understanding and meeting of the minds. Right, and so right. I think that there's a lot of stuff here that we're going to see. And that charge alone is 20 years. So the stakes are pretty high here for him.
And I mean, people need to understand that that's basically like a peacetime equivalent of charging people with treason. And it's right. very, very, very rare that anybody's even been charged with that. By the way, unlike a lot of the MAGA insurrectionists who pled the fifth over and over when testifying in front of the January 6th committee, Henry Tario was quite happy to speak to staffers. And he said, among other things, that he thinks the Oath Keepers are a bunch of goofballs. That's my word, mm-hmm. not his, but like right. middle-aged goofballs in like camo. Right. And he hates Oath Keepers founder and right-wing grifter Elmer Rhodes. He said that their bad blood goes back to an incident in Portland where both of these street gangs went to harass leftists. And Rhodes promised to hire a bunch of buses to transport all these goons out of town after the event, but he didn't follow through. Which right. left 300 Proud Boys, according to Tario, on the sidewalk trying to get Ubers to get them out of the city. And right. I found that a little entertaining. I mean, fascists yeah. are often pretty incompetent.
I mean, it's incredible. I might have said this before on your show because I literally say it all the time. However smart you think you are, trust me when I tell you, federal prosecutors are smarter than you. You know, they're going to outwit you, and they are very good at tripping people up. So I hope that, you know, he's aware of what he's walking into here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're going to have some very interesting developments in all of this in 2023. And, you know, the process is a slow one, and I share many, many people's frustration with the pace of it. But it looks like we are coming to some sort of culmination. Brandy, yeah. go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, one of the things I like to think about when I get impatient with the timeline myself, you know, fast and furious was what we had on January 6th. What we're all going through right now, what we've been witnessing, this long slog, this is our democracy, flawed as it may be. This is civil society. This is how we do things in this country. This is actual law and order. So I think if we're patient, you know, I know that's a lot to ask. I think we'll end up seeing some really good stuff come out of this. You know, the Rhodes conviction was a good thing for the United States. It was a good thing for victims of the attack. It was a good thing for the family members of those defendants who, like Rhodes's estranged wife, you know, who spent a lot of time talking about how abusive and how dangerous he was. So I think that we did some good. I think that the committee transcripts are going to keep filling in the blanks. The committee did some great work, and now it just is up to the top. We have to make sure that people at the very tippy top are held accountable.
Brandy, I believe we are out of time. I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today and for leaving us on that high note.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I also want to thank Michael Grunewald and David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I'd like to thank the good folks at Alternet and Raw Story for supporting the show. You can follow me on various social media. You know, right now I'm really enjoying Mastodon. That's where I'm hanging out at the moment. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And I would like to thank all of you good folks for tuning in. Have a terrific holiday. There's lights on the trees and there's wreaths to be hung. There's mischief and mayhem and songs to be sung. There's bells and there's holly, the kids are gung-ho. True love finds a kiss beneath fresh mistletoe. Some families are messed up while others are fine. If you think yours is crazy, well, you should see mine.